you can, I will now be happy to introduce each of the participants in tonight's discussion. Rabbi Meir Kahane, who was recently elected as a member of the Israeli Knesset, is founder and former national chairman of the Jewish Defense League. He is a prolific writer who has had many volumes published on a range of issues relating to American Jewry, Israeli politics, Jewish law, and concepts. As one of the most controversial figures on the contemporary Jewish scene, Rabbi Kahane has attracted widespread media and public interest in his views and actions. And it's with great pleasure that I welcome Rabbi Kahane to this kehillah. Professor Alan Dershowitz is professor of law at Harvard University and has been described by Newsweek magazine as, and I quote, "the nation's most peripatetic civil liberties lawyer, one of the nation's most peripatetic civil liberties lawyers, and one of its most distinguished defenders of individual rights." He, too, is a prolific writer, his works having appeared in law journals, books, magazines, and newspaper columns throughout the country. To you, Professor Dershowitz, welcome. Tonight's debate will be moderated by our own Rabbi Avraham Weiss, who is a spiritual leader of the Hebrew Institute. Rabbi Weiss is also professor of Judaic Studies at Stern College, as one of the leading activists for Jewish causes. He is a member of the executive committee of American Friends for a Safe Israel and is national chairman of the Student Struggle for Soviet Jewry. Under his leadership, the Hebrew Institute, we believe, and I say this with great pride, has really become one of the most creative and dynamic synagogues in American society today. It's with great pleasure that I hand over the microphone to Rabbi Weiss to open the program.
If I can ask everyone to please rise for a moment. I've thought long and hard as to how to begin this evening's event. Our topic is the future of Israel, and so what better way than to recite a tefillah, L'shlom Medinat Yisrael, a prayer for the welfare of the State of Israel. And as I recite this prayer, our thoughts are with Chayalei Tzahal, the strongest physical and the strongest moral force on the face of this earth. Avinu sheba shamayim, tzur Yisrael v'goalo, barech et medinat Yisrael, reishit tzmichat gulatenu, hagen aleha bevrat chastecha, uferos aleha sukat shlomecha, ushlach orcha v'amitcha l'rasheha, sareha v'yoatzeha, v'taknem be'etza tova milfanecha. V'yached levavenu li'ava u'yira et shmecha v'lishmor et kol divrei toratecha, הופעה בהדר גאון וזכר על כל יושבי תבר ארצך, ויומה כל אשר נשמע בפו אדוני אלוהי ישראל מלך, ומלכותו בכל משלה, אמן סלע. And as we debate this evening, there are literally millions of our brothers and sisters who are oppressed. I refer specifically to Soviet Jews, to our black brothers and sisters in Ethiopia, in the Sudanese camps, to Arab Jews, specifically in Syria, and our thoughts and our hearts are one with them. May it be God's will that people like Anatoly Sharansky and all that he symbolizes, that all of our oppressed brothers and sisters soon be free, and that we be able to dance together with them in Yerushalayim, not next year, but this year and next year until the end of time. Amen. Please be seated. I've been asked by Mike Zimmet, who is heading our security, that all aisles should remain clear. My role is to moderate. Hillel Jaffe, the president, is keeping the time. We are beginning with opening statements of 5 minutes apiece. Our first speaker, Professor Alan Dershowitz.
Thank you all very much for braving this rainy evening and coming up to Riverdale. I want to particularly thank my mother and my relatives who took the long trip from Brooklyn and some of my former students and my friends. And I want to express great appreciation for being allowed to speak at Rabbi Weiss's congregation. We in Cambridge hear so much about what is going on in Riverdale and the kind of spirit that is infused into people who ultimately, many, become my students after they've left Riverdale, and Rabbi Weiss deserves enormous congratulations for the job he's doing here. It should come as no surprise that Rabbi Meir Kahana and I would end up debating this issue. We started in exactly the same place. I have in front of me a Xerox of two pictures, one of Rabbi Meir Kahana as he was a captain of the Brooklyn Talmudical Academy debating team in 1949, and then another picture of me as captain of the Brooklyn Talmudical Academy debating team in 1953. We never had the privilege or opportunity to debate each other then, but our connections go back even further than that. In fact, my mother tells me that our family is responsible for Meir Kahana's very presence. It was my grandfather who sold his father his engagement ring. Many of my friends, when they heard I was making the trip down to Riverdale from Cambridge, asked me the question, why debate Meir Kahana? Are you not legitimizing his views? Are you not acknowledging his right to become part of the Jewish dialogue? Obviously, the Riverdale press agreed with that position, and there are some pickets outside who support that position. So I want to start out by using my few minutes to explain why I thought it was and think it is very important for me to debate Rabbi Meir Kahana. I am debating Rabbi Meir Kahana because too few blacks debated and responded to Reverend Jackson and Louis Farrakhan. I am debating Rabbi Kahana because virtually no Arabs are willing to debate Yasser Arafat and Muhammad Gaddafi. I think it is imperative that the world understand not only that the vast majority of Jews repudiate Rabbi Kahana's views, but also why we repudiate those views. I am here as well to demonstrate my unalterable opposition to those Jews, Israeli and American, who seek to silence Rabbi Kahana. I recall very vividly spending election night in Israel with a group of the most distinguished lawyers and judges in Israel. And as soon as the ballots were counted and Rabbi Kahana's seat in Knesset announced, these very distinguished, well-intentioned people sat around that room deciding how to silence Rabbi Kahana, who had been democratically elected to one of the most democratic houses of parliament in the world. Some said, let's make it a crime to say what he believes, and such legislation has been drafted. Some said, don't let him run, or we shouldn't have allowed him to run. Others said, do not let him take his seat in the Knesset. Some said, take away his immunity. Others said, strip him of his Israeli and his American citizenship. Deport him. Blacklist him. To me, the democratic response to Rabbi Kahana is to answer him, to compete with him in the marketplace of ideas, to persuade people to reject his ideas on their merits and demerits. The democratic answer to bad speech and offensive speech is not censorship or blacklisting, but rather more speech, more debate, better ideas. I just finished this weekend trying to resolve my ambivalences about the speech of a terrible enemy of Israel, a woman named Vanessa Redgrave, who was blacklisted by many organizations and who was not allowed to perform by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. My response to that was both to support her right to speak, but then to challenge her to a debate on the merits of her abominable views toward Israel. She declined that debate because her party, the Socialist Workers' Revolutionary Party of Britain, forbids her to debate, forbids her to take positions other than those which have been justified in advance. I am debating Rabbi Kahana because I want to upgrade the quality of the debate, to stop the kind of name-calling and personalization that has characterized so much of the attack on Rabbi Kahana. I am here because I disapprove of guilt by analogy, because of efforts to show that he is just like Nazis who deported Jews, enacted Nuremberg racial purity laws, and conducted Kristallnacht. These analogies constitute an insult to the memory of the 6 million. As I hope to show during the course of this debate, there is enough wrong with Rabbi Kahana's views without confusing them with the views of others who are also wrong. I want to find out here precisely what Rabbi Kahana's views are, and I want to try to answer them on the merits. So I wait with great interest your views and this debate. Thank you.
Opening comments. Opening five statement, Rabbi Meir Kahana.
Thank you. The greatest of tragedies is not that there are those who call me names, but there are those who would grant me the right to speak because they would also grant the right to speak to Yasser Arafat. That is the greatest of tragedies. That Jews are unable to understand the difference between a Farrakhan and an Arafat and a Redgrave on the one hand and Rabbi Meir Kahana on the other hand. The subject this evening is the state of Israel, its future, where it is going. I can only repeat now the words that I spoke in the Knesset in response to the speech by Shimon Peres, the Prime Minister, who discussed the overwhelming problems facing Israel, the economic problems, Lebanon, and so on. If nothing else, this evening I hope that everyone leaves this building with an understanding that we stand today at a crossroads, that the fate of the Jewish people rests in our decision to do that which is right, that which is Jewish, that which is Judaism, that which is the yoke of heaven, and not that which is Western concept and the gentilized Western culture that has unfortunately gripped us. If we stand today and ponder, how is it possible that a Jewish people that gave onto the world geniuses of finance, Jews who created economic empires for Gentiles, how is it that the same people is unable to create in its own country economic stability? And if we ask ourselves, how is it that the same army, and as Rabbi Weiss said, the most potent physical force, the moral force, how is it possible that this most potent physical force, which in 1967 destroyed in 6 days Arab armies, today is incapable of dealing with a band of PLO hoodlums? And the answer is that one who is able to speak about the state of Israel without mentioning God understands nothing. And one who was able to speak of the solutions to the problems, Shimon Peres spoke for 42 minutes, and not once did he mention God. And so he is incapable of understanding the solution because he doesn't even understand the problem. ויהיים לא תשמע בכל השם אלוקיך לשמור לעשות את כל מצוותיו בחוקותיו. It should come to pass if thou would not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God to observe all his commandments. ישלח השם בך את המערה, את המומה ואת המגירת. The Lord shall send upon thee cursing, vexation, failure, and failure, and failure. והיית ממשש בצהריים קשה ימשש העיוור באפלה, ולא תצליח את דרכיך. And thou shalt grope at noonday as the blind gropeth in darkness, and thou shalt not prosper in thy ways. יתנך השם ניגף לפני אויביך. The Lord shall cause thee to be smitten before thine enemies. That is what is happening today in the state of Israel. From a magnificent miracle, a state of the Jewish people, we have turned into a state of anarchy, a state of confusion, a state of despair. And people this evening will speak about democracy in Western culture and equality and all of the things that have no relevance to Judaism. What will be? That is the ultimate question that is asked in Israel. The national slogan, Nu Mayiye, Mayiye, what will be, what will be, what will be, depending upon what we decide. If we walk in God's path, the state of Israel will become the opening door to the redemption of the Jewish people. But if we go in the ways of Cambridge, and if we go in the ways of Harvard, and if we go in the ways of the gentilized Hellenists of our times, then surely we will be destroyed. The yoke of heaven is that which we must take upon ourselves. The yoke of heaven, if we do so, we in the state of Israel shall be the harbingers of the redemption.
There are many rounds to this debate. The first round deals with the issue of Jewish state or democracy. The question in the first half of this round is directed at Rabbi Kahana, who has between 3 and 4 minutes to respond, and then Professor Dershowitz has a moment to react to Rabbi Kahana's answer. Rabbi Kahana, many of the Palestinian Arabs whom you want to transfer or expel are peaceful villagers who have no intention to hurt Israel and are children and grandchildren of people who lived in Judea, Samaria, and yes, are citizens of Israel from the Galil. Many have said that your plan to evict Arabs is not only an affront to the world as a whole and to the vast number of Israelis, but also to those rabbis who are at least as knowledgeable in halakha as you are. I am not aware of one great halakhic authority who supports your eviction plan. These rabbis do not base their beliefs on Hellenistic notions or Western concepts as you'd have it, but on the halakha that you yourself subscribe to. Nonetheless, they have concluded that your plan is repugnant to halakhic principles. How can you feel justified in imposing upon Israel the eviction principle if the dangers of doing so are so great and if the halakhic moral powers against it are so great?
It is impossible to answer that question in 3 to 4 minutes. One, no Arab in Israel wants to live in a Jewish state. And one who thinks so has contempt for the Arabs. You have to have contempt for an Arab to believe that he enjoys standing and singing his national anthem, Hatikva, as he sings the words, Nefesh Yehudi Homia, the soul of a Jew yearns. You can imagine the pride that fills his heart. As he concludes, Hatikva bat shnot alpayim, the hope of 2,000 years, and he thinks, ah, how my Zayda waited 2,000 years for the Jews to come home. Every Tisha B'Av, they used to sit and mourn, when are the Jews coming home? The state of Israel was created as the Jewish state, and so it is declared in the Declaration of Independence. What Arab wants to live in a Jewish state? Would you want to live in a Christian state, Jerry Falwell? Yes. The fact that Arabs don't rise up now is only because they're afraid. Wait. That which they did to us in the 1920s and 1930s. And have we forgotten that already? The Jewish memory goes back perhaps 3 weeks. The massacres of Jews in Jerusalem and Jaffa and Hebron and Tzfat. The 510 Jews massacred between 1936 and 1938. And the Mufti, that which they did to us then, they would do to us tomorrow when they can. Secondly, the question arises, assuming that they have become saints, I accept that, they have all become saints. And they sit then, democratically, they reproduce saints. I don't want to live under a majority of Arab saints. I didn't leave this country to live in Israel, to live as a minority under anyone, saint or devil. So the question that I throw back is, to all of those people that are upset at the things that I say, what is your answer to the following question? Do the Arabs have a right? Hypothetically, do they have a right to become a majority, democratically, peacefully, in the state of Israel? And when they do, you can bet that the law of return, which today applies only to Jews, will not apply to Jews, but to Arabs. Do they have that right? Yes or no? If the answer is yes, that's fine. You are Democrats and not Zionists. If the answer is no, then you're Kahana. The question... The question of the halakha is one that disturbs me, but it disturbs me greatly because I know what rabbis have said to me privately. It bothers me that we live in a generation, an orphaned generation, when rabbis know what the halakha is and are afraid for various reasons to say it, so that when I hear from a chief rabbi, Nachon Atatzodek, yes, you are right, but we can't say it. We can't say it? Of course we can say it. The halakha is clear, and I'll challenge any rabbi to any debate. The halakha is clear that a non-Jew in a Jewish state cannot be a citizen, cannot hold office, cannot elect, has no say, he has no national rights, he has only individual rights. So of course we must take the stranger and treat him well. Of course we must give him charity and treat him well culturally and economically and socially, but he is not a citizen. He is a ger toshav, a resident stranger who must accept upon himself misim ve'avdut, tribute and servitude. I didn't say that. The Talmud says it. The Rambam says it. And if you want to, you can burn your local Rambam.
It's dangerous enough when Rabbi Kahana purports to speak on behalf of all Jews, but when he also purports to know what's in the minds of all Arabs, we really do have a problem. People vote with their feet and with their ballots. And if Arabs choose, for whatever reasons they want to, economic reasons, political reasons, reasons of geography, reasons of convenience, to remain Israeli citizens, that's what they will remain. And Meir Kahana will not be able to and should not be able to expel or deport valid citizens of Israel. When Israel was established, those who established it, from Theodor Herzl way back to Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, realized Zionism was a challenge. It is a great challenge to keep the Jewish state both Jewish and democratic. Rabbi Kahana would throw up his hands and would say there is no room for democracy. There is nothing Jewish about democracy. I beg to differ. The vast majority of Jews in this world support both Zionism and democracy. The false dichotomy that Rabbi Kahana is seeking to impose on us is not correct. And the ultimate implications of his dangerous view are once the Arabs are expelled from Israel, then Jews that do not fit Rabbi Kahana's particularistic definition of his kind of Jew will be expelled. And I throw the challenge right back to Meir Kahana. The vast majority of Jews in Israel today are not Orthodox Jews, and yet Israel is a Jewish state. What would you do under democratic or Jewish principles to the vast majority of Jews who dispute your approach?
We may have to limit applause because time is of the essence. In the last half of this first round, the Jewish state democracy issue, Professor Dershowitz, let us assume that Israel withdraws from all of Judea and Samaria. We're back to the 67 lines. Many fear that the high Arab fertility rate coupled with the low Jewish Israel fertility rate and increased emigration of Jews from Israel would lead to a situation in which Arabs will constitute the majority population within the 1967 borders by the middle of the next century. If granted citizenship, they would vote as a bloc to render null and void the essential aspects that make Israel a Jewish state, including the law of return. Through democratic means, they would undo the Jewish nature of the state. Are you, Professor Dershowitz, prepared to accept the workings of democracy if those workings result in a state that is no longer a Jewish state?
You have just stated very articulately the challenge of 21st century Zionism. I do not shrink from that challenge. I do not think most Israelis shrink from that challenge. To say that we understand the challenge is not to say that we can anticipate all the factors that will eventually lead to a solution to the problem. The decision will not, by the way, be made by Alan Dershowitz. It will not be made in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It will be made by Israelis who live in Israel, who have elected Israel as their home, whose sons and daughters confront life and death decisions every day. It would be incredibly presumptuous of me to try to tell Israelis what to choose if that conflict occurred. I can only say what David Ben-Gurion's answer was, what Golda Meir's answer was, and what Chaim Weizmann and Theodor Herzl's answer was. The answer was, we must struggle to preserve the Jewish character of the state of Israel. We must encourage Aliyah. We must open the doors of Soviet Jewry and of Syrian Jewry and of Ethiopian Jewry. We must do things to encourage demographic changes that will ensure that Israel remains a Jewish state. We must not accept, under no circumstances must we accept or may we accept, the choice being put to us, the choice about being a Jewish, undemocratic state where the minority prevails, or a non-Jewish, democratic state where the majority prevails. We must not allow that false dichotomy ever to face us. If and when the time comes, if through all efforts by Israelis there is no other way of resolving the issue, it will not be resolved by the rhetoric of Meir Kahana. It will not be resolved by the answers of Alan Dershowitz. It will be resolved by the people of Israel through the processes which they have elected, through the processes which put Meir Kahana in the Knesset, through the processes which allow Meir Kahana to speak freely in Israel, where he would not be able to speak freely in almost every other country in the world. The democratic processes, the liberal processes, the libertarian processes, the freedom processes, the very egalitarian processes that Rabbi Kahana eschews. But mostly, the decision will be made in Israel, by Israelis, under the circumstances that prevail in whatever year this crisis occurs. Let me simply end by saying that a most recent study by demographers at Hebrew University completely undercut the likelihood that this is going to happen. It is a hypothetical. We law professors are experts at answering hypotheticals, but you ought to realize it is just that, a hypothetical. There is no realistic likelihood that in the immediate future this challenge will be presented, and I am confident that if it is presented, it will be solved in both a Jewish and a democratic manner. Thank you.
That was about 5 minutes of not answering the question. The question was, hypothetically, assuming, would you be prepared, you, as a Jew, and I'm suddenly amazed at the modesty of my opponents. He, of course, has never offered any views about Israel. Never, ever. Suddenly he becomes modest. It is too presumptuous of me to offer a view. Offer it. Because this is not a question of Israel. This is a question of the Jewish state, and you're a Jew, and the Jewish people have a vested interest in that Jewish state. Let's not speak of, the answer is, Aliyah. I see how many Jews are leaving Harvard. It's not a question of, in the immediate future, there is no, I agree with you, tomorrow there will not be a majority of Arabs, nor in 2 weeks. But the question is, when the Arabs become a quarter of the population of Israel, Israel will have a Northern Ireland on its ends. The Galilee today has a majority of Arabs. Wadi Ara has a majority of Arabs. Umm al-Fahim. The Mishulash, the triangle, has a majority of Arabs. That is the question. And who are we to speak about? The experts say, what experts say? What experts say? The Arabs of Israel have grown from 11% to 18% within the state of Israel, despite a huge aliyah of Jews from Arab countries. Today there is no aliyah. The Arab aliyah has been an internal one, fully, totally. My God, I don't want to wait to see the knife on my throat. The wise person is one who sees tomorrow today.
The second round, the topic is Judea and Samaria, although obviously it relates to the first round as well. We reverse the order and the question is directed to Professor Dershowitz. Professor Dershowitz, what is your position on Judea and Samaria? Do you believe that Israel has a biblical and or legal and or security right to Judea and Samaria? If it does, why not exercise that right immediately? And if you favor territorial compromise in Judea and Samaria, such compromise will inevitably mean that Jews will be forcibly evicted from the areas Israel has relinquished. Over the past 40 years, between 800,000 and 1 million Jews living in Arab countries were expelled from their homes. Isn't the policy of territorial compromise in Judea and Samaria a policy of eviction? Isn't it as morally repugnant as Rabbi Kahana's, except that Rabbi Kahana is more honest in establishing his policy and talks of expelling Arabs, while the territorial compromise plan is a more deceptive one, but in the end will lead to the eviction of Jews from the area?
Rabbi Kahana, I hate to disappoint you, but I always speak, when I speak about Israel, with reluctance and with reservations, because I have not made the decision to move to Israel. You have. You vote in Israel. You are a member of the Knesset. I am a Jewish supporter of Israel, and I speak with great diffidence when I speak about ultimate positions that Israel should take. I do think Israel has a biblical right to the West Bank. I also think the Arabs have a biblical right to the West Bank. I also think there are Christian biblical rights to Jerusalem. I do not believe that in a world of 1984 in which we live, we can, without war and without rancor, resolve disputes by resort to conflicting biblical claims. I do not want to see the world enmeshed once again in a war over conflicting biblical claims, because there is no room for compromise when one invokes the name of the Bible and claims, not only am I right, but I alone am right. So although I agree that there is a biblical claim, I would expect that a state would not seek to resolve the issue solely on the basis of a biblical claim. I also believe, and will not spend time on it, that Yehuda Blum is right in claiming that Israel has the best legal claim to the West Bank. His article in the Hebrew University Law Review brilliantly explores that. Nonetheless, I believe in territorial compromise. I do not, however, believe in eviction. I do not believe that territorial compromise necessarily entails that a single Jew ever be evicted from the West Bank. What I do believe is Israel should not, under any circumstances, compromise its security needs, compromise its need to keep Arab enemies from its large cities. I do not, under any circumstances, favor the return of the pre-1967 borders. I do not, however, think that in the long run it is in Israel's interests, and were I an Israeli member of Knesset, this is the way I would vote. I do not think it is Israelis' long-term interests to maintain control over large Arab population centers. I would insist that Jews be permitted to live in any part of the West Bank that they choose to live and be adequately protected in those areas. Nor do I believe in the establishment of a Palestinian state, that is, a government which is entitled to a foreign policy, a government which, like Nicaragua, claims the right to have Soviet MiGs flown in. I do believe that there should be a certain degree of autonomy, domestic autonomy, by Palestinians within large cities. To that respect, I generally agree with the Alon plan. I generally agree with what I think the vast majority of Israelis agree with, and that is a willingness to make some territorial compromise in exchange for assurances of peace. I know this will not be a popular position. The wise, thoughtful, reasoned compromise position almost never is. But it is the position which, deep in my heart, I am convinced will strengthen Israel, will secure Israel, will make Israel able to cope with the 21st century in both a democratic way and in a Jewish way. So that's my approach to the West Bank.
Anyone who believes that by giving up parts of Judea and Samaria and by offering an autonomy which basically gives the Arabs the right to run their own sewage system will bring peace is either a knave or a fool. And Professor Dershowitz is not a fool. The fact of the matter is that if you speak about peace, you will never have peace if you don't give the Palestinians, as they call themselves, their own homeland. Of course they'll never want peace. What are they, fools? Why can't we realize that they have a national pride? Why can't we realize that they believe that time is on their side? Why can't we realize that? I am against compromise on Eretz Israel. One cannot say in 1984, whether it's 1984 CE or BCE, the same rules govern us. If we have faith and do that which God wants and do not give up land, then both logically and religiously we will find safety.
The last half of the second round on Judea and Samaria, the question directed to Rabbi Kahana, and I remind everyone that the one who answers has between 3 and 4 minutes, and then the rebuttal is for a moment. Rabbi Kahana, your position, as I understand, is that the only way Israel can incorporate Judea and Samaria into its midst while maintaining a Jewish majority is by expelling Palestinian Arabs. For those in favor of complete Jewish sovereignty in Judea and Samaria, there is an alternative solution. Incorporate Judea and Samaria, grant the Palestinian Arabs in the area the right to become citizens of Israel with equal rights and obligations to pay taxes and serve Israel in the National Service Program. Jews will not become a minority in the land. According to the Israeli Census Bureau, the percentage of non-Jews living between the Mediterranean and the Jordan since 1967 has dropped. Palestinian Arabs are emigrating from the area on their accord. Why preach eviction, which is repugnant? Is there not an alternative solution?
No, there is not. The fact of the matter is that all of these figures that are thrown around are figures that speak about the times when the oil-rich states were doing well. Today, in Kuwait, in Saudi, and those countries, they are beginning to fire workers, foreign workers, and they are returning home. And home is Judea and Samaria. The truth of the matter is that the State of Israel faces a problem not only in Judea and Samaria. The state of Israel faces the same exact problem without Judea and Samaria, except 30 years later. Why can we not understand that if the Arabs will be given the choice, the only choice, either leave or stay and be citizens and serve with national obligations, that they will choose the national obligations, since they are convinced that time is on their side? Can you not see what is happening today in Israel, in the Knesset? Muhammad Mi'ari of the New Arab List has proposed a bill. Demanding that the Arabs be granted the right to serve in the army. That's all we need. The Arabs are not fools. We are the fools. The Arabs will accept national rights and obligations as long as they are convinced that by so doing, they will stay there, be citizens, vote, and they will be the majority. What is wrong with us? Why can we not see this? Giving up land does nothing but bring them 15 kilometers closer to the coastline. Not giving up land and keeping the Arabs there guarantees another million and a quarter citizens. That's all that's missing. We will have to bite the bullet. We will have to understand that this is not a question of merely expelling Arabs. This is part of an exchange of populations that began in 1948 when 750,000 Jews fled Arab countries. And who remembers that? And when I speak of compensation to Arabs for their property, did anyone give the Jews of Iraq compensation for their property? And the Jews of Syria? And Egypt? And North Africa? I want to complete an exchange of populations. We have taken in the Jews. Now let's give the Arabs our Arabs.
The third round will deal with the issue of religion and state. We reverse the order. And so the question is directed at Rabbi Kahana. Rabbi Kahana, you envision Israel, as I understand it, as a theocratic state governed by the laws of the Torah. What is your precise vision of that state? Does it square with reality? At this time, 75% of the Israeli population is non-observant. If there were a Sanhedrin, there would be daily stonings. Without a Sanhedrin, thousands would be imprisoned for violating the law daily. Fearing this possibility, it is conceivable that the vast number of Israeli Jews would leave the state. Why not promote greater observance through programs of teaching Torah in a spirit of love and concern rather than through coercion and strong arm tactics?
Clearly, there should not be one Orthodox Jew in the world that would not want a theocratic state. Or, putting it better, there should not be one religious Jew, not Orthodox Jew, religious Jew, who would not want a state which is mandated by the Torah. The Torah is not limited to the kitchen and the bedroom. The Torah is an entire way of life, mandating laws that to us, who are products of an assimilated America, and indeed, assimilation begins not by marrying a non-Jewish woman or man, but by absorbing and assimilating the non-Jewish concepts so that we can continue to observe the Sabbath and eat kosher and by all means glot. And at the same time, when it comes to the very difficult things that come into conflict with modern life, such as theocracy versus democracy, are Jews and Gentiles equal? These are painful things, and so we avoid them. And we say, perhaps it would be better to teach people. Obviously, it would be better to teach people. But the Torah mandates a coercion. Such as, it would be so much better if we taught people not to rob banks. In the meantime, we have police. Thank God. Of course, education is the ultimate hope. But in the meantime, the Torah mandates a coercion, because that is what God wants. Now, we have got to be honest. We have got to be honest. Ad matay atem poskim al shtei asipim, Elijah said. How long do you halt between two opinions? Are we going to be Jewish? Or are we going to be products of a Western gentilized culture? We cannot be both. We must decide. Certainly at this moment, the possibilities of such a Jewish state, and that is a real Jewish state, as opposed to a state of Jews, which Israel is. Israel today is not a Jewish state. It is a state of Jews, or perhaps a Hebrew-speaking Greece. But it is not a Jewish state. And the possibility of our creating such a Jewish state does at this moment seem a remote thing. But should we reach that point where it would be possible, how can you ask an Orthodox rabbi, would you want to see such a theocracy? Is there one Orthodox rabbi that would not? And so, I would never ever risk a civil war. God forbid. God forbid. But certainly, our ultimate aim must be such a state. And if that state will not be, the state will not survive. The future of Israel, peace, we hear of, but we must have peace. The verse that was quoted so incredibly out of context. The verse by the prophet was a criticism of the Jewish people for crying about a false peace. Peace, peace, but there is no peace. That was the criticism. Look at the context, professor. Peace will come, you know when? When the Jewish people does that which God wants. That's when peace will come. And if we indeed will not be able to create a Torah state, then God forbid, the Almighty will bring down upon us the punishment that He warned about in a Bible which is as applicable in 1984 as it was in the year 84.
Rabbi Kahana, I fully understand the context in which the statement was made, and it still expresses a preference for an incomplete peace over no peace at all. And when you live in the real world and expect that human beings will determine their own destiny, at least now, if not in some messianic future, you must resolve questions of this kind by practical devices. I believe in Zionism. I believe in a Zionism that is a principle of choice, of opportunity, of challenge. Rabbi Kahana sees Zionism as a principle of compulsion, of separatism, and of exclusion. I think that there is no way of debating or arguing with somebody who thinks all the right is on his side, and he speaks in the name of God. Until God speaks to us in much clearer ways, we as human beings will have to resolve these disputes among ourselves.
Professor Dershowitz, the last half of round three on the question, religion and state. You have been a firm advocate of the separation of church and state. Do you believe that existing elements of Jewish law, as applied in Israel, is a violation of that principle? For example, should the Israeli rabbinate be in control of marriage and divorce, or should civil marriages and divorces be permitted? Should the rabbinate decide the who is a Jew question, or should the civil courts? If the rabbinate should be the arbiter of these questions, doesn't this violate the separation principle? If the rabbinate should not be the arbiter, and there exists a separation of church and state, what would be, in fact, the distinctive Jewish character of Israel?
If I were the absolutist that Rabbi Kahana was, this would be an impossible question for me to answer. But for me, every answer must arise in context. What should be impermissible in the United States, a pluralistic society, founded many hundred years ago by people of the most widely diverse backgrounds, having had people come to its shores from every country under the earth, having had over 700 different religions represented. What is right for America is not right for Israel. What requires an absolute separation of church and state in this country because of its history does not require the same kind of separation of synagogue, mosque, church, and state. In Israel, compromise is in order. I thoroughly approve of relegating some religious issues to the rabbinate. For example, the question of what is a Jew? What is a Jew for halachic principles, for principles of religious law, must be decided by the rabbinate. Who is a Jew for other purposes, for example, for purposes of deciding whether we will support a Soviet emigre who claims that he is a Jew but was not properly circumcised or was born of an assimilated Jewish father and Gentile mother? These are very practical questions to be resolved in practical ways. I represent dissidents in the Soviet Union who claim to be Jewish and who are not halachically Jewish. I regard them as a Jew for purposes of emigration from the Soviet Union. When they then get into Israel, the question may very well change. There are questions of great practicality. You do not want to have a Jewish state which has a diverse array of definitions of Jewishness so that people who are regarded as a Jew for one purpose then decide that they are technically mamzerim under law for other purposes. Yes, compromise is in order. Compromise is the essence of achieving these purposes. I am neither for Israel, again I speak with diffidence at a distance, a total secularist nor a total believer in the theocratic state. These are issues which must be resolved by Israelis themselves, and let me tell you, I think it is a very difficult dilemma. As you may know, the Israelis have not adopted a Bill of Rights. There used to be only one reason why the Israelis didn't adopt a Bill of Rights, and that was because they couldn't resolve the issue of synagogue and state. There are now two reasons why the Israelis don't have a Bill of Rights. One, they can't resolve the issue of synagogue and state, and second, they can't resolve the issue of Meir Kahana. Seriously, that is really an important issue in the Bill of Rights, because if a Bill of Rights were to be written in Israel today, it would be written so as to exclude Rabbi Kahana from the coverage and protection of its principles. I would be unalterably opposed to that. And so I think principles of separation apply in Israel, but they apply as matters of degree, to be established in a sensible way, taking into account the Jewish character of Israel, but also taking into account that Israel is a Jewish state in a different way than Rabbi Kahana would see it. Rabbi Kahana, you're in the minority in Israel. You're in the minority in every possible way. I am pleased that you were elected to the Knesset because I thoroughly approve of Israel's democracy. But let's put your election in context. Had you gotten the number of votes you got in Israel, in the United States, you would not even be on the ballot of most of our states. You have gotten fewer votes than Angela Davis, the Communist Party, than Lyndon LaRouche, than the progressive pig farmer in New Jersey. You are a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the population of Israel. You speak for virtually no one. We must defend your right to speak, because if your principles were ever established in Israel, you would be the first to be silenced.
I want to tell you that by the same token, if the number of people that voted for the Likud would have voted in this country, they would have gotten one seat in Congress. And I would have hoped that we could have kept this debate on a level above that of a demagogue. A minority? If that would be the standard by which we judge truth, then every Jew had better become a Christian or a Muslim. For we Jews are a tiny, tiny, tiny minority. I am not for the separation of synagogue and state in any way. The Jewish people has only one purpose for its existence. Only one reason why we should have one more people in this myriad of so many peoples, and that reason is only because we at Sinai received the Torah. You cannot separate that in any manner, shape, or form.
The fourth round deals with the issue of the future of American Jewry. We reverse the order again, and the question is directed to Professor Dershowitz. As one of the most prominent lawyers in America today, you seem committed to the future of America. Do you feel that the Jew has a place in that future? Statistics seem to indicate otherwise. Intermarriage has reached 50%. 50% of American Jews are unaffiliated with any synagogue or Jewish organization. 40% of members of cults and Hebrew Christian groups are Jewish. And according to a recent Hebrew University study, 72% of American Jewish children between the ages of 3 and 17 receive no Jewish education. Eliyahu Bergman in Midstream 1977 predicted that by the year 2076 there could be as few as 10,000 Jews left in America. These statistics point to a spiritual holocaust for American Jewry. Do you agree? Do you believe that there is a future for American Jewry, or is Israel the only place where the destiny and future of the Jewish people will unfold?
Anyone who had the chutzpah to try to predict the destiny of the Jewish people after the many thousands of years and the many thousands of twists and turns that our destiny have gone through would be indeed either a prophet or a fool. I claim the title to neither. Rabbi Kahana agrees with me, I think, as to both of those claims. We won't talk about the knave. But I do think there is a great future for Jews in America. I just think about my own experience. When I came to Harvard in 1964, it was very difficult to be a Jewish Jew at Harvard University. Today, in 1984, being a Jewish Jew is a very good thing to be at Harvard. It is very much approved. We are making an enormous impact at places like that, notwithstanding Meir Kahana's negative views of places like Cambridge. Jews are alive and well and thriving in America. I think from the point of view of active Judaism, the statistic you left out certainly has to do with the fact that there are more Jews today on university campuses closely affiliating with Jewish activities, whether it be the Harvard Jewish Law Students Association, which I see some of its former members out in the audience, or various Hillels, which I'm sure Rabbi Kahana would disapprove of, but of which I thoroughly approve. I think there is tremendous opportunities, but there are also tremendous challenges. The statistics you state are obviously cause for great concern and great worry, and every Jew in America must take that issue very seriously. But the vast majority of American Jews simply will not, and here I make a prediction, simply will not in our lifetime move to Israel. They will surely not move to Israel if Rabbi Kahana and his voice becomes louder and bolder. So we're operating here at cross purposes. Rabbi Kahana would like more Jews to move to Israel, and yet he is contributing enormously to the reduction of Jews moving to Israel because of the fear and the hate which he has generated. Good Jews in America don't want to go to Israel to sow hatred. They want to go to Israel to try to live in peace. And if they are told by one of the most eloquent and articulate representatives of a Jewish point of view that you cannot go to Israel and hope to make peace without compromising your most basic principles, it is Rabbi Kahana who will then be chasing Jews from Israel and from commitment to Jewish values in America. Yes, I believe that there's a place for Jews in America. I think we are a troubled people. I think we have false prophets in our midst. I think we must fight against those false prophets, and they come in various guises. I see the great dangers of theocracy even in America when I pick up a disgraceful ad in last week's Jewish press, which dares to say, after listing a group of distinguished rabbis, that at a public meeting at Beis Yaakov School on the first day of Chol HaMoed, the above Rabbanim clearly stated that according to the Torah, it is forbidden to vote for Congressman Stephen Solars. When that kind of disgusting, theological rhetoric appears. And when people tell me, Rabbonim tell me, that my Torah, and it's not only your Torah, it's my Torah, tells me who to vote for, then I truly worry about the future of Druze in America. But you can be sure that I and many who agree with me will devote our lives to fighting for a stronger Jewishness and Americanism in America at the same time.
I'm convinced that had the year been 1925 in Berlin, the same rabid pro-Germanism would have been heard. And with logic and with reason, but certainly Jews would have risen and said, at Heidelberg it is much easier to be a Jewish Jew today than it was 20 years ago and 50 years ago. And he would have been correct. What a tragedy. If it's really your Torah, then know what the Torah says. Go home and live in the land of Israel. That's what the Torah says. And to take an advertisement from the Jewish press and to condemn the person by taking it out of context, those rabbis did not say, I've seen it and that's why I mention it. Those rabbis did not say the Torah says you are not to vote for Solars just stam kacha. What they first did was to take stands on issues. The question of abortion on demand, or gay rights, or so on. And a congressman who is for these things is against Torah.
The second half of this round, a question to Rabbi Kahana about the future of American Jewry. In Time to Go Home, published in 1972, you wrote, quote, there is a dark cloud on the horizon of the American Jewish future. It signals a storm such as we have never yet seen. It warns of the beginning of the end of the American Jewish community. The time to leave is now while there is yet time, end quote. It is 12 years later and it hasn't happened. There are pockets of anti-Semitism throughout the United States. We've just completed a presidential election where Jesse Jackson, an anti-Semite, ran for the Democratic nomination. Nonetheless, American Jewry, on the whole, is rather secure. Some would say very secure. Some have suggested that the JDL lost strength over the years because your prediction of an imminent Holocaust did not come true. Do you still believe that American Jewry will experience a physical Holocaust in the very near future? Or is the real challenge for American Jewry spiritual rather than physical? Do you see any future for American Jewry? Or is the only answer Aliyah, emigration to Israel?
I think that I love Jews. And that's not easy. And if I wanted to be popular, I would not necessarily take the stands that I do take. Of course the stands that I take are unpopular and lead to attacks on me, personal attacks and defamation. And of course when I answer the question, yes, I believe that God forbid a physical Holocaust can happen here. Of course that's not a popular stand. Who wants to leave Riverdale? Israel is a nice place to visit, but to live there? So because I love Jews, I tell you, you can stone me, But the answer is, the Almighty declare that a Jew who lives outside of the land of Israel is as one who has no God. And the Talmud tells us that it be better to live in a city in the land of Israel with a majority of heathens than Borough Park. It doesn't say Borough Park, but it says then in a city in the exile with a majority of Jews. Are these things just games? What's wrong with us? If we believe that the Torah is indeed God's law, if we believe in a God who is a transcendental being, who exists and who gave us a law to follow, how dare we say, I like this and I don't like that? That's not my kind of Torah. When the Almighty freed the Jews from Egypt, He did not say, you are now free to live in Riverdale, or in Golders Green, or in Toronto. He said, you will go to the land of Israel for a reason, so that you would not become part of a majority non-Jewish culture, so that you will live in your own country, separated from the nations. And that's why each Saturday night, I presume in Boston they still make the Havdalah, we say, Hamavdil Bein Yisrael Lamim, he who separates between the Jews and the Gentiles. That's not the way it is in America. And that's not the way God wanted it. And we, God help us, have become so assimilated that the words that I say seem so foreign to so many Jews. But this is authentic Judaism. Yes, Rabbi Weiss. With all my heart, I feel and I fear that a terrible, terrible tragedy is taking place. We have Jews for Jay, Jews for Jesse, and Jews for Jesse. Jews for Jesse Jackson, and Jews for Jesse Helms. And they're both bad for the Jewish people. And on the left, we have a Jesse Jackson with a terrible, terrible liberal anti-Israel movement. And on the right, there's a Jesse Helms, a Jerry Farwell, and a Christian Right. And if we have any brains, God, we will see that God gave us a state so that we would have the time, we would have the trufa, the medicine before the illness struck us. In the name of God, go home before it's too late.
I've had many surprises tonight, but I didn't think I would be called a rabid pro-Americanism person. I think that people who I've been criticizing in the United States and in the administration would be very interested to hear that characterization. My answer really is in the form, in the traditional Jewish way, of a question. And that is, what would Rabbi Meir Kahana have a Jew like me do? A Jew who does not want to go to Israel? A Jew who wants to spend his life defending Jewish values, Jewish human rights in the United States and around the world. A Jew who wants to stand up for the Jews of the Soviet Union, whether or not they want to go to Israel. A Jew who wants to fight Jesse Jackson and Jesse Helms. A Jew who wants to stand up in support of the rights of Jews in America, both those Jews who elect to go to Israel and those Jews who don't. Is Rabbi Kahana really saying that this is a futile effort, a self-defeating effort? Should we simply pack up our bags and go home and not continue to fight for Jewish rights in America? If Rabbi Kahana says yes, do you agree? That's really the question I want to put.
The fifth round deals with the very serious issue of oppressed Jewry. The first half is directed to Rav Kahana. Rabbi Kahana, you have often preached that violence is a legitimate means of protest on behalf of Soviet Jewry. At times, the violence has led to injury and even death. Whenever and wherever there has been an attack, your standard response has been, we were not involved in the action, but we applaud it. Do you applaud the death of Iris Cohns, a Jewish woman working for Saul Yurick, who was killed, albeit unintentionally, by a bomb placed in or near the Yurick office in the early 70s? Is violence always worth it? And while I'm at it, Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union is at a standstill. Thousands of Ethiopian black Jews are starving in death camps in Ethiopia and in the Sudan. Arab Jewry, especially Syrian Jewry, is in deep trouble. What is your broader plan of helping these oppressed Jews?
I certainly don't applaud the death of a Jewish woman any more than Menachem Begin applauded the death of 79 Jews at the King David Hotel when he bombed it. Life is not an easy thing. Perhaps it's easy now in 1984 to think that the Soviet Jewish struggle was always known to the world. That's not true. 15 years ago, it was an unknown thing, except to a relative handful of Jews. And 15 years ago, Jews were not getting out of the Soviet Union. And it was only violence that put the issue on page one of a New York Times, which was so much more interested in Vietnam and in Cuba and in all the other areas except Soviet Jewry. Who wants violence? No one wants violence. Who wanted violence against the Nazis? Only those people wanted to defeat them. Violence is a terrible thing. But violence is sometimes a terribly necessary thing. Now, easy it is to be against violence when we have no problem. But when the Jews in Leningrad and in Moscow and Odessa and throughout the Soviet Union read in Izvestia and in Pravda and saw on television Jews in New York City fighting violently for them and rioting for them, do you know what that meant to them? It meant to them that finally, after 50 years of not hearing any Jew who cared, finally somebody cares for us. Somebody cares for us. I mourn the terrible death of a Jewish woman, just as I mourn the death of 60 young Israeli soldiers who were killed when our own planes by mistake bombed Israeli tanks in the Lebanese war. War is terrible. And we have smart bombs, but we don't have genius bombs. And I know more than others the efforts made by militant Jews. They endangered themselves to ensure warnings to Russians. Of course, it's a terrible thing. But if today the Soviet Jewish emigration has almost stopped, might we not ask ourselves the question, is there a correlation between the fact that Soviet Jews are not getting out and the fact that JDL today is not what it once was? I tell you that in the Soviet Union, and as was mentioned in the Knesset, there is a smell of blood in the air. The Soviet Union is preparing show trials and an atmosphere of Jew hatred which will lead to pogroms. And we feel nothing about it. This coming Sunday, we will be at the Soviet mission. I hope thousands will come, and we intend to sit down and block traffic and get arrested. Believe me, there's nothing to it. You'll be in and out. Come and take part in it. And let us put again the Soviet Jewish issue on page one. The Jews of Ethiopia, the tragedy is that we will never erase that shame of a state of Israel which refused for racial reasons for all those years to bring in those Jews. We will never, never be able to wipe out that shame. Today, thank God, and I sit on the Knesset Committee on Aliyah, and we hear secret memos and so on. There is something being done in that area. Not enough. Not enough. We are paying today for the fact that we were so good and so nice and so moral when Jews cried out.
One of the worst of the many JDL canards is that the Jewish Defense League is responsible for the emigration of Soviet Jewry from the Soviet Union. The credit belongs only in one place: those brave, heroic Jews of Leningrad and Moscow who were prepared to endanger their own lives, without endangering the lives of others, who I ultimately represented in the courts of Moscow, who hijacked an airplane in order to put the issue of Soviet Jewry on the front page of the New York Times. The only people who resent Rabbi Kahane's claim more than I do that the credit belongs solely to the JDL are those people in the Soviet Union to whom I've spoken, who have said over and over and over again that the promiscuous violence, the death of Iris Kohns, is what made their struggle so much more difficult. And if Rabbi Kahane talks about the accidental death of Iris Kohns or the accidental slaughter of Israelis by Israelis, how does he justify his statement last week in the newspapers when when some Israelis deliberately, with premeditation, killed an innocent Arab young man riding on a bus, somebody whose views we will never know, somebody whose personal attitudes we will never hear? And this is what Rabbi Kahane said: "May the hands which did this be strengthened. It was a brave and noble act." Rabbi Kahane, Rabbi Kahane, Rabbi Kahane, and Shifra Hoffman too, that is a despicable, that is an anti-Jewish, that is a racist, that is a horrible statement. And I ask those of you, who are cheering for the opposite or booing for this, to consider: do you really want your cheers and boos to be interpreted as a statement that the deliberate killing of an innocent, innocent Arab human being is something that you are prepared to justify? Sleep with that on your conscience tonight.
Friends, we are running a bit late, so if we can hold the reaction, for it's taking a great deal of time. The last half of this round on a press jury, a question to Professor Dershowitz, which touches a little bit on what he said. In the best defense, which you penned, you state that your abhorrence of violence made you realize that the JDL way of protesting on behalf of Soviet Jewry was not your way. In the same chapter, however, you write that Rabbi Kahane's lectures to you in Shmuka Bernstein's motivated you to become more involved in the cause of Soviet Jewry. Although you detest violence, does violence have a place in the orchestration of activism on behalf of Soviet Jewry and other oppressed Jewry? It may not be your way, but is it one way to help the cause? And let me ask the same question I asked of Rav Kahane. Soviet Jewry, Ethiopian Jewry, and Arab-Syrian Jewry are suffering more than ever. What is your broader plan of helping these oppressed Jews?
First of all, I want to acknowledge that I have been influenced by Rabbi Kahane's writings and his preachings. I want very clearly to distinguish among his good ideas and his bad ideas. I do not condemn everything that Rabbi Kahane writes or stands for. I think the great tragedy is he poses the questions so often correctly and then offers simple-minded solutions which generate immediate applause and immediate rhetorical responses but provide for no adequate program for working the issues through. So I want to appreciate what Rabbi Kahane has written and has said about some of the problems confronting Jewishness while rejecting his violent answers. Do I think violence has a place? I think violence certainly is an issue of last resort, not first resort. I think Rabbi Kahane has cheapened the currency of violence, has cheapened the currency of civil disobedience. Let's remember the cause for which Iris Kohn died. And I feel very, very strongly about this because I represented some of the people who were charged with the killing of Iris Kohns. And I have a very hard time, obviously, dealing with the fact that through my limited legal talents, we managed to get these people off and they were acquitted and free. I think that was the just result, because I don't have a single-minded definition of justice. Here I will quote correctly, without fear of criticism, from the Bible: "Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, justice, justice, two sorts of justice shalt thou seek, the means of justice and the ends of justice." I do not think you can have an end of justice without the means of justice. And I believe that that was a just result, but it's a difficult one. It's difficult when one has to defend people who are charged and who may be factually guilty of carrying forward death of innocent people. Jew, Arab, it makes no difference to me. The death of an innocent person is a tragedy beyond belief, Again, to quote from the sources, he who kills but a single person as if he had killed the whole world, and he who saved a single person as if he had killed, saved the entire world. I do not accept the killing of a single innocent person. And what was the cause for which Iris Kohns was killed? She was killed because a Soviet balalaika orchestra was going to be playing that night in Carnegie Hall. And so, because of inspiration, and I'll stop at that, inspiration of Rabbi Kahana, six young men carrying bombs walked into the offices of Saul Urock and the offices of Columbia Artists and dropped those lethal devices, not intending to kill, but knowing full well that the risk of death and the reality of death was there. I firmly believe that that action was immoral, that it set back the cause of Soviet Jewry, that it set back the cause of Jewry. I'm not here to tell you that under no circumstances would I engage in violence. I agree with the statement in the first chapter of Rabbi Kahana's book that were I a Jew living in the United States in the 1930s and 1940s, I would have chained myself to the gates of the White House. I would have engaged in civil disobedience before I allowed the St. Louis to depart the shores of this country with Jewish emigres, Jewish people who wanted not to go back to the Holocaust. I would have done that. I would have engaged in civil disobedience. I think it is far more difficult today to engage in meaningful civil disobedience because of Rabbi Kahana's cheapening of the claims of civil disobedience. Nobody listened after a while, Rabbi Kahana. Nobody paid attention because you failed to distinguish between the critical and the frivolous. You were prepared to kill over music. You were prepared to kill over a balalaika orchestra. When you're prepared to do that, when you're prepared to generate applause for young, innocent Arabs who are killed while commuting in a bus, who may, for all we know, support Israel, when you're prepared to do that, you have ended and not begun the debate over what is the appropriate role of civil disobedience.
During World War II, Allied bombers every night flew over Germany and dropped bombs on German cities. Professor Dershowitz, who were they killing? Generals? Professor Dershowitz, they were killing women and children. I presume had you been alive at that time, you would have protested that too. After all, were all Germans against justice and morality? But we were fighting a nation that as a whole was committed to a terrible, terrible cause, which would have had, in one, wiped out the Jewish people and so many other peoples. And so to end that war, our Allied bombers made terror raids over Tokyo. There were firebombings of Tokyo. Tens of thousands of women and children died. Would you have protested that? The tragedy is, that we are supposed to give a medal to someone who says, yes, had I lived then and known that the Germans were killing Jews, I would have chained myself to the White House gates. Well, if I would have been living there, I would have tried to kill Nazis. One final point. Music. We were against music. The attack on Saul Urock's offices were part of an ongoing campaign against the cultural exchange with the Soviet Union for a reason. When the Bolshoi comes here, when the Moscow Orchestra comes here, and people come and listen and observe, no one can walk out of that concert feeling as bad about Russians as before they walked in. The Russians don't send culture here to acculturate the Philistines. They send it as a political weapon, and that's what we fought against. We've reached the sixth round, and we're dealing with the question of the so-called Jewish underground, TNT. This question is directed to Professor Dershowitz. What are your feelings about the Jewish underground? Specifically, in my recent visit to Tel Nand, when and where I visited the settlers, I was told that you had visited the prisoners as well, and that you had told them that you do not believe that they can receive a fair trial in Israel. What did you mean by this? Secondly, one of the alleged plans of the settlers was to blow up the Temple Mount, a plot they say they shelved as far back as 1982. But I'm interested in your thinking about the Temple Mount. Today it is governed by the Waqf, an administrative arm of the Jordanian government. Jews are not permitted to worship there, even in places where the rabbinate has said it would be permissible to do so. And in the New Republic of June 18, 1984, it was reported that the Waqf has set about eliminating any evidence linking the Temple Mount to the pre-Islamic period. Do you believe, Professor Dershowitz, that the Temple Mount should be open to Jewish, and for that matter Christian, prayer, and should be protected by Israeli forces rather than by the Jordanian Waqf?
I deplore any limitation of access to any places in Israel which are of importance and as important as these are to all religions. Of course, I would much prefer to see the Temple Mount open to all. And here I'm going to, I know, get lots of opposition, but I would also like to see it open to Jews who don't comply with the rules of the rabbinate and who want to go and see it as a sight-seeing place. I don't believe in restrictions. I think rabbis should tell Jews that they shouldn't go to certain places, and it's up to an individual person to decide where and when to go. I visited the alleged terrorists in Tel Mon, and I visited them because I had great doubts and still do have grave doubts as to whether they can receive a fair trial. I purposely went to Israel to make that decision for myself, as I go to other places in the world to see whether or not people in trouble, and particularly, though not exclusively, Jews in trouble, can get a fair trial. My fear about a fair trial was that almost everybody I spoke to in Israel, and I include among them judges and prosecutors, had extremely strong views on these yet untried defendants. Half of the people I spoke to said we should lean over backwards to do something helpful to them. The other half said we should lean over forwards to punish them even more severely. In that kind of a climate, I think it is very, very difficult for a fair trial to be achieved. I don't think it's impossible. I think it's a struggle and a great challenge. I personally have enormous respect for several members of the Israeli Supreme Court, Aharon Barak among others, who has been assigned to make rulings on these various issues that are now pending before the courts. Aharon Barak, who also made it possible for Rabbi Kahana to run for the Knesset, having overruled the decision of the election commission. I have great faith. I think the challenge is very, very grave indeed. As to the acts which the alleged terrorists were accused of committing, and as a lawyer I'm using my words very carefully because the proof has not yet been established, if these acts are approved, I deplore them. I don't think the solution to religious conflict is taking the law into your own hands and committing violence. I deplore any effort by Jews, Arabs, Christians, atheists, anybody else, to destroy a holy site or a holy place. Just imagine, put yourself in the position, and imagine for one moment what would happen if, God forbid, the Kotel were to be attacked by terrorists. What we would feel as Jews, how much to the heart of our religion and very being it would go. If you want a guarantee, an absolute guarantee of a jihad, an absolute guarantee of extending the war against Israel to include active participation by Iran, active participation by Gaddafi's Libya, active participation by Egypt. If you want to see that kind of escalation of the war, if you favor a kind of Jesse Helms Armageddon scenario, which would hasten the coming of the Christian Messiah, which is why so many of the right in America favor a brand of Zionism with which I thoroughly disapprove. If you want to see that, then yes, tolerate the blowing up of the Temple Mount. But if you want to see any hope of peace, any hope of rapprochement, any hope of non-war, any hope of rational discourse, Israel must strongly oppose terrorism, must strongly oppose taking the law into one's own hand, must strongly oppose denigrating the Israeli army and the Israeli services whose job it is in that state to protect Israelis. And so I hope that the Jews who are facing trial in Israel get a fair trial, an absolutely fair trial, a trial in which nobody leans over forward and nobody leans over backward, a trial in which due account is taken of the fact that these Jews did not want to destroy the state of Israel, but instead in a misguided way sought to protect valid interests. But a verdict that also takes into account the reality that no nation can survive if it allows vigilante justice, really vigilante injustice, to take over from one of the greatest legal systems in the modern world today, the Israeli judiciary.
I have no problem with the question of whether there will be a fair trial or not. What bothers me is that there is going to be a trial. It's a disgrace to the Jewish people. Outside of Jerusalem, in the corridor, in the Prosdor, there is a settlement named Ramat Raziel. One day I traveled out there and I asked, who is this Raziel? And they said, great hero, great hero. Then I wandered in East Talpiot and I saw a street, Rehov Raziel. And I said, same, sex, hero. We opened a snif, a branch, in one of the cities, Netanya. And there was on Rehov Raziel. Who was this great Raziel, this great, great hero? He was head of the Irgun, who in the 1930s, in retaliation for Arab killing of 510 Jews, placed bombs in Arab marketplace in Jerusalem, Haifa, and Jaffa, and killed hundreds of Arabs. He's a hero? What's the difference? What's the difference? They're not criminals. They are Maccabees.
And to Rabbi Kahana, the second half of this question dealing with the Jewish underground, specifically if the government of Israel, after the establishment of the state, has the religio-legal status of what Rabbi Cook of sainted memory called Malchut Yisrael, the Kingdom of Israel, how can you support a military force which operates outside of the framework of the government of Israel and the Israeli Defense Forces? Doesn't this constitute rebellion against the state? And secondly, do you see a distinction between a focused action, as apparently was the case in the attack upon the Arab mayors, and a random action, such as the alleged attempt to blow up the five buses and the most recent attack? How can you condone an action which results in the killing of Arabs for all we know may have been supporters of the State of Israel?
Had I been the Prime Minister of Israel, would I be the Prime Minister of Israel, please God? Not one Arab would ever be injured, because not one Arab would be in the State of Israel. But as long as there are Arabs in the state of Israel, know that Jews will be killed. For all we know that the Arab who was killed was a supporter of Israel, one has to be insane to believe that an Arab from East Jerusalem or from the village of Seir, from which where this fellow came from, one of the most unbelievably vicious Jew-hating villages, really is a supporter of Israel. I don't want to kill Arabs. I want to expel them. But if the government of Israel will not expel them, it guarantees the murder of Jews. It guarantees the murder of Jews. And therefore, I am not for a vigilante group. I believe that if the government of Israel will not expel them, then the government of Israel should do what it did in 1969 and 1970 under a labor government. In Gaza, when Arab terror reached its peak and they sent Ariel Sharon there, you know what he did? You know how he put down terror? He threw grenades into the post office in Gaza and killed 14 Arabs. That was the government. Now, if you don't want individual terror, at least let's have governmental terror. And if you don't want that, then do the best thing. Elect me the prime minister and we'll expel the Arabs, and may they live well and happily elsewhere. The attacks by the Jewish underground, as it is called, were in retaliation for specific attacks. A bus 18, Jerusalem was blown up. Have we forgotten already? And 6 Jews murdered there. What are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do? Moshe Tamam, have you heard that name? No one has heard the name. A soldier murdered in Israel, his eyes gouged out and his testicles carved out. Did you know that? You don't know that. What are we supposed to do? Eli Lupo, a soldier, hitching a ride at Summit Beit Lid near Netanya, got his ride in an Arab car and was axed to death in the car. Esther Ochana, hit by a stone in the head. We in the army are always told, if they throw stones at you, you don't fire because stones are not dangerous. Chaval, pity, no one told this particular stone. She was killed. What are we supposed to do? Donny Katz, a 15-year-old boy, leaves his Haifa home and is caught by 6 Arabs from Sakhnin, an Israeli Arab village. Our Arabs, perhaps they loved Israel too. They raped him and murdered him. Every one of those Jews is our fault. We are to blame. We are to blame for this immorality. And of such immorality do our rabbis speak when they say, Kol amrachim al achzar sofo liot achzar al harachaman. One was mercy on the cruel, who someday be cruel unto the merciful. What would you say? What if we're speaking of what would someone say? What would someone say if tomorrow morning I went to Mecca and I built a little shtibel, not a big one, a little shtibel on the Kaaba, the holiest site in Islam? Can you imagine what the jihad there would be then? You know why? Because the Arabs have pride, national pride and religious pride, and they believe. And we allow the Arabs on the holiest site in all of Judaism to build a mosque. I don't want to blow up any mosque. I want to move it. And that site is not a holy Muslim site. They came on what they knew to be the holiest site in Judaism and deliberately built that mosque there. Let them have their mosques, but not there. And it is a disgrace to the state of Israel that Muslims can pray and Jews cannot pray.
I can imagine somewhere in Iran an Ayatollah standing up there and saying, "We don't want to destroy the Kotel, just move it. Just move it." And imagine what this would do, how we would feel if somebody ever dared to make that kind of a claim. But what we have heard here today is an absolute justification for the most primitive form of collective responsibility. Remember hard what Meir Kahane said. There are no innocent Arabs. To kill any Arab is to wage war against the Arab people. Let us not forget the memory of collective responsibility. Now, what do you do? What do you do about horrible acts? And I join the rabbi in condemning the brutality that he described. When you become a mature state, certain responsibilities go along with that. The United States of America felt horribly frustrated when it could not retaliate against those unknown terrorists who killed our Marines. There was a possible answer. We could have gone in and promiscuously killed the innocent, but we, the United States, did right by not doing so. It is frustrating to be a state. The one thing you have to do when you're a state is you have to distinguish between the guilty and the innocent. Once you fail to make that distinction, once you justify the killing of an innocent deliberately and with premeditation, you cease to have the responsibility that comes with being a mature state.
Friends, we've reached the seventh round. We'll try very hard to finish all ten. When we get to the ninth, the format will switch ever so slightly. The seventh round deals with Jews and minorities. And the question is directed to Rabbi Kahana. During the recent campaign, you were behind the Jews Against Jackson campaign to the point of encouraging Jews not to vote for Mondale because of the Jackson connection. From the very beginning of the JDL, you often found yourself in confrontation with the black and other minority communities. Haven't your activities ignited the passions of hatred between Jews and black and other minorities? Shouldn't the black and Jewish communities, who have both a long history of persecution and oppression, be brought together rather than be driven apart?
There's no question that until I came on the scene, Arabs and Jews lived together. Until I came on the scene, blacks and Jews lived together. The JDL came into being because there was a black-Jewish confrontation. And have we already forgotten Ocean Hill-Brownsville? And have we forgotten already the attacks upon Jewish teachers and the attempt to threaten and intimidate Jewish civil servants? Have we forgotten Les Campbell on radio station WBAI reading that infamous anti-Semitic poem, "Hey Jew boy with the yarmulke on your head, hey Jew boy, I wish you were dead"? Of course, we exacerbated it. I have nothing against blacks, I have nothing against whites, I have nothing against greens. I believe that all people are equal, for good and for bad. And when they're good, they're good, and when they're bad, whether they're white or black. And a black man is as bad as a bad white man when he's bad. And Jesse Jackson is bad. I find it incredible. If Jesse Jackson would have been white and said what he said about Jews and about Israel, and had he been in the GOP, and had Ronald Reagan refused to read him out of that party, can you imagine what the B'nai B'rith and the Riverdale, whatever your local rag is, would have said? Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Well, I can imagine. But when it comes to Jesse Jackson, that's different. Why? Because he's black. Well, to me, that makes absolutely no difference. There is a black-Jewish confrontation today. On many, many issues, Jews are at opposite poles with blacks. When it comes to merit, Jews are for merit and not for quotas, affirmative action, because that is the death of Jewish advancement. When it comes to the question of Israel, blacks are with the third world and Jews aren't. So let's stop papering over problems. I don't think Jews should go with blacks or with whites. I think that just as blacks go for black interests first, and I appreciate that, Jews should go for Jewish interests, because for us, Jewish interests come first.
Jews should vigorously oppose both Democrats and Republicans who don't take our interests seriously into account, whether it be the Democratic Party's refusal to stand up as strongly as they should have to Jesse Jackson, or the Republican Party's refusal to stand up to the anti-Semitism of Jesse Helms. I think we have a fight to be fought in this country against relegating Jewish values to the bottom of the heap, and we have to continue that fight. I think Rabbi Kahana did not do wrong in increasing sensitivities over some of these issues early on and even now. The question, again, is not one of ends, but one of means.
And just the last half of the minority question to Professor Dershowitz. You've been long involved in the cause of civil rights. Hasn't the recent direction taken by the black community, as expressed specifically in the Jesse Jackson campaign, proven that your efforts have backfired? Jesse Jackson received the vast majority of black votes while embracing Arafat and Farrakhan. Leading Jewish establishment figures labeled Jackson an anti-Semite. The historical link between the Jewish and black communities, and for that matter between the Jewish and the third world communities who wish to destroy Israel, have been broken. Will you continue to reach out to these communities who have so categorically rejected us and in some cases have done everything within their power to destroy us?
I will unequivocally continue to try to build bridges, but bridges which are equal in direction from the middle to one end to the other. I think it's critically important that Jewish and black leaders continue dialogues, continue to do what we do in Boston, Massachusetts, where we have Freedom Seders every year, where we try to bring together the most progressive elements of the black communities, those who support Israel, and let's not paint with a broad brush. The 11th Amendment should be, "Thou shalt not stereotype." And we cannot stereotype. There are many great black leaders in this country, whether they be Bayard Rustins, who are strong Zionists, or other young leaders who have recently gone to Israel and have changed their minds and have stood up, some too quietly, to Jesse Jackson. Blacks in this country constitute a very significant and growing minority. Hispanics do as well. We must reach out to every community without compromising our own integrity. We must continue to fight within every community those who would make alliances with our enemies. We must continue the struggle at every front. Are you asking, have the Jewish involvements in the civil rights movement been a failure? I have to tell you, in all candor, they certainly have been a disappointment. And nobody expected anything better. One does not involve oneself in the civil rights movement the way a plantation owner might involve himself with plantation workers. The ultimate goal of a civil rights movement is to create equal people who have their own values and see their own interests. We must continue to try to persuade leaders within every one of the communities that their interests and ours correspond in support for a strong Israel, in support for values that we believe in and they believe in. We must continue to build alliances with people who oppose us on 90% of the issues and yet can agree with us on 10% of the issues. Coalition politics is the nature of both the United States and the way we, as a 3% majority in this country, minority in this country, have survived. We must continue to use all of our resources, whether it be training students at Cambridge, Massachusetts, for leadership positions in the bar and in business and other activities, or continuing our dialogue with people in all walks of life. We cannot give up on any community. 10 years ago, who could have predicted that the Reverend Falwell would now support Israel for reasons that are only completely understandable to him? And who would have understood that we would have coalitions with people who seemed our enemies 10 years ago and enmity with people who seemed our friends? It is the essence of Jewish leadership, and I want to commend the very organizations which Rabbi Kahana constantly attacks: the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, the Anti-Defamation League, groups that build bridges, groups that reach out, groups that play hardball, groups that do not accept simply a one-way street, groups that provide adequate intelligence so that we know from whence the current enmity is coming. Information is power. We must be prepared. We must not refight the battles of the 20s and the 30s, but be prepared for the battles of the 80s and the 90s and the next century. And these major organizations, they're not always right, but these major organizations are critical as part of our continued fight and our continued attempt to reach out to build coalition. We should not stand alone. We must insist. We have helped others to overcome, and now they must help us to overcome.
Nonsense. Now, the fact of the matter is, that Bayard Rustin speaks for no one except Bayard Rustin. He is the greatest Uncle Tom that there is. The young black doesn't want to hear of Bayard Rustin. The young black is a militant. The young black is for Jesse Jackson. Stop playing games here. The American Jewish Congress, the committee, are disasters. They are the ones that have destroyed the American Jews. They, with their melting pot philosophy, destroyed our young people and told them the 11th commandment, thou shalt melt. The fact is that we don't have enough time and enough money and enough resources to worry about blacks or Chinese or Hispanics. Every penny of Jewish money and every ounce of Jewish energy has to be put into our own problems to save our young Jews and bring them back to being Jewish. This is what has to be done. In the end, the Jew has no one to look to except himself and his God.
On this, the eighth round, we'll depart from what we've been doing because I think we're running a bit late. It's a two-sentence question to both Rabbi Kahana and to Professor Dershowitz. I believe that Professor Dershowitz will respond first. He'll have 3 minutes, and then Rabbi Kahana will have 3 minutes. Are you in favor of a Jewish alliance with fundamental Christians? Is the trend towards conservatism throughout the world, do you view it as a positive or a negative factor for Israel?
I view the growth of fundamentalism in the United States as a negative factor for Americans, for Jews, and for Israel, and yet I believe in alliance. I believe in alliances with anybody who can affect our destiny. I believe with Rabbi Kahana that we must put the interests of our community at the top of the list, and I think the most effective way of putting our interests at the top of the list is to know how to deal with everybody. What I don't want Rabbi Kahana to do is to tell my children and my grandchildren when they come, and my students and my friends, that they have to choose between being Jewish and supporting the rights of blacks or the rights of others. For two reasons. One, it's a false choice. Second, I fear what they will choose. And so even if one wants to stick to completely pragmatic grounds, we must persuade the young Jews in America that they need not reject everything good and right that they have been taught, that they need not reject the best of Judaism and accept the worst of Judaism in order to consider themselves a good Jew. I don't want my children to think that they must accept as a commandment, thou shalt kill, thou shalt disregard the rights of others, thou shalt live in a segregated and exclusivist society, thou shalt not contribute to people who are poorer than you. I have the right to tell you, Rabbi Kahana, and I am telling you that there is another Judaism that rejects those values. There is a Judaism which is positive. There is a Judaism which is embracing. There is a Judaism of Rav Hillel that reaches out and gives the best of what we stand for to our children. There is a Judaism that does not require our kids to choose between a neo-fascist philosophy and a democratic philosophy in order to be a Jew. I want my children to revere the memory of Martin Luther King and to revere the memory of Rabbi Heschel. I want my children to cry bitter tears if again we experience Japanese Americans being placed in concentration camps, because to discriminate against anyone is to discriminate against everyone. One need not choose between pragmatism and morality, because the moral choice is the pragmatic choice. To choose to defend the rights of others is to choose to have others defend our rights. You'll remember the philosopher who said, when they came for the Jews, I didn't say anything because I wasn't a Jew. And when they came for the communists, I didn't say anything because I wasn't a communist. And when they came for the gays, I didn't say anything because I was not a gay. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak.
I don't know what is Judaism and what is Dershowitzism. But I do know that if one decides for himself what is Judaism, that is not Judaism. That is Dershowitzism or Cohenism or whatever name it is. The things that I say are halakha. And I would never, ever, Dr. Dershowitz, Professor Dershowitz, ever attempt to argue with you about law. I would hope that you would have the same modesty when it comes to halakha. I think that there is an arrogance of ignorance. There is. I don't believe that the fundamentalists are our allies, just as I don't believe that the liberals are our allies. And just as I was opposed to Jews being knee-jerk liberals, I'm opposed to Jews being knee-jerk conservatives. I want Jews to be knee-jerk Jews. I was one of the first to say we can use the Christian fundamentalists for Israel, because they are for Israel, not because they love Jews or love Israel. They believe that their Messiah will come when the Jews return to Israel and when the Jews win, and so on. So I said, well, let's use them. But let's not get into bed with them. Let's not let have a Christian embassy in Jerusalem, which is the heartland of missionary work in Israel. Some years ago, I went to Plain, Georgia, to Jimmy Carter's church. I notified him that I wanted to give a sermon. Sermon on the Plains. Now, when I arrived, I spoke in the courtyard, and the message that I gave is the message that we should give to the fundamentalists. I said, listen, we Jews don't need you. The state of Israel will survive because it is God's hand. But God help you if on Judgment Day God asks, did you help my people Israel? God help you if you say no. So for your sake, you'd better help Israel.
We've reached the ninth round, and we'll change the format ever so slightly. Within 1 minute, I shall ask Rabbi Kahana if he would have one priority question to ask of Professor Dershowitz. What would that question be? And then we'll give Professor Dershowitz 2 minutes to respond.
Well, I suppose I would ask him, for such a very bright fellow, how come you don't see that what I'm saying is true? No, that is not the question. Now, that is not the question. I would ask a far deeper question, a far more painful question. For a Jew who does not accept, and again, I don't know, but assuming that one does not accept, for a Jew who does not accept the literal fact that God appeared at Sinai and gave the Torah to the Jewish people. For a Jew who doesn't accept that fact, and that the Torah is the Word of God, the literal Word of God, why be Jewish? When one says, I'm a Jew, he automatically sets up a wall, a barrier, between Jews and non-Jews. And if all that being Jewish means is being ethical, surely I admit to you that there are ethical Catholics and ethical Protestants and ethical Buddhists and ethical atheists. Some of my best friends are ethical atheists. The question arises, therefore, why be a racist? Why be Jewish? If not for the reason that we Jews have the one thing that no one else in the world has, a Torah given by God.
I think there is an enormous difference between the quality and content of one's private beliefs, and my private beliefs certainly do accord with those of Rabbi Kahana, and trying to impose my private beliefs in a secular world on those who don't agree with them. I believe that the Jewish Torah is the right way. I believe that every Jew has an obligation to read it and get from it what one sees and how one sees the correct views of the Torah. I think that's very important. But I cannot sit and quarrel with an equally committed Christian or Muslim or Hindu who says, mine is the only right way, mine is the only right way. The only result of saying that as a Jew, mine is right and yours are not only wrong, but there's no room for yours in the world, is Armageddon. I am not so confident in the exclusive correctness of my views that I want to sacrifice the life of my children and my mother and my family for Rabbi Kahana's battle. If he wants to do that, let him do that by himself. But I want to continue to try to create a pluralistic world, a world in which Jews who accept Rabbi Kahana are free to do so, in which Jews who accept Rabbi Soloveitchik are free to do so, in which Jews who accept the Satmar Rebbe are free to do so, and in which Protestants who accept Protestantism are free to do so, so long as neither the Satmar Rebbe's observers nor the Protestants extend the reach of their arm to the point of my nose. Because at that point, I will fight back, whether it's Rabbi Kahana or the Satmar Rebbe or Jerry Falwell. What we need in this very crowded world today is a sense that Rabbi Kahana can do what he chooses to do and that the rest of us can choose to do what we want to do. This is not a question of picking the one shul that can sit on a one square block premises. We are lucky. We can build many shuls. We can build shuls and temples and mosques and palaces, and we can all worship in the way we wish to worship. And what we have to avoid is the Kahana solution, which says that Jews can only exist if our temple erases all other temples, if Judaism is regarded as the only true way, even for those who reject it as their way. My answer is Jewishness and pluralism.
And the last half of this round, if Professor Dershowitz could offer the priority question to Rabbi Kahana within a minute, and Rabbi Kahana has 2 minutes to respond.
I would like to hear Rabbi Kahana answer the question that I've tried to put him on several different occasions this evening. And that is this. We're not talking about Dresden, where we had to bomb cities in order to bring a war to an end in which the goal was military and the means that we used to achieve it may have involved the killing of some innocent people. We are not even talking about Hiroshima. We may be talking about Nagasaki, the second bomb, which most moralists would today condemn. I am asking Rabbi Kahana how he can justify telling people to go out and take innocent human life, knowing that the only effect is going to be to take innocent human life. How he can do it without either falling into the trap of collective responsibility in which he says everybody who was born an Arab is equally guilty of the crimes of the worst of those excesses of Arabs, or else reject the principle of personal guilt.
I find it an incredible lack of honesty to speak about Dresden was a war, and therefore it was all right to kill 80,000 people in one night. What do you think Israel is doing now with the Arabs? What are we in? A love fest? Of course we're in a war. It's a terrible war because we refuse to fight the war. We set guidelines which destroy ourselves. I repeat again. If I were the Prime Minister, and with God's help, and those who live in Israel know the tremendous groundswell that is taking place today in Israel for the Kach movement. If I were the Prime Minister, I would not bomb Arab buses. I would not kill Arabs. I don't want to kill Arabs. I would expel the Arabs. I would wish them well in any one of their 22 countries. But since I'm not the government, and this bungling, gentilized bunch of Hebrews refuses to take action, what are we expected to do when the Arab mass offers a place of cover and refuge four terrorists. We don't know who the terrorists are. What are we supposed to do? This is a war. And just as you justified the bombing of Dresden, of Tokyo, and you justified it here, will I justify this?
We've reached the final round. I had the extraordinary opportunity, together with my family, to have dinner with Rabbi Kahana and Professor Dershowitz. And surprisingly enough, I didn't even have to be the referee. Somehow, when people are sitting over supper, although there are many differences, there are many, many points in common. And it's to that background and to that sense of personal insight that I devote my last question, and then there'll be a final summation. Professor Dershowitz and Rabbi Kahana have, in a certain sense, similar youth backgrounds. In fact, they both did attend Yeshiva University High School of Brooklyn, BTA. Since that time, both of you have diverged remarkably in your paths. Today, you personify different views within the Jewish spectrum. And so the last question of this evening is, what motivated you and who motivated you most to travel the paths you did? And what do you think of your opponent's accomplishments and contributions to the Jewish cause? Professor Dershowitz.
Okay. I have no question about who motivated me and what motivated me most. My parents, undoubtedly, and my family. I grew up in a household where my father, of blessed memory, always talked about defending the underdog. Always talked about standing up for those who were least able to stand up for themselves. He always rooted that in the deepest of Jewish values. My grandparents before him, my mother, who is here tonight, has always seen much more clearly and with much greater Jewish vision than Rabbi Kahana. The great paradoxes, the great challenge of being a Jew, the rejection of simple-minded solutions, the necessity of obeying the commandment that when you live in a country, you obey the laws of that country, that you be a good patriotic American citizen at the same time that you are a good Jew. But at the same time, accepting the best of Jewish tradition. My father was not a great Jewish scholar, but I think he understood, because through his blood and through his veins coursed the history of the Jewish people, the experiences in Poland, the experiences in other parts of the world. My grandfather went to Palestine in the 1930s and came back with great stories of the Chalutzim. These were my inspiration. These continue to be my inspiration. The great challenge is to try to be a good American and a good Jew without putting the Americanism first. I am a Jew first, as I define it. And I will never allow Rabbi Kahana to define my Jewishness for me any more than I will allow Ronald Reagan to define my Americanism for me. The challenge of life is to define one's own goals and what's own means. I offer my program to you. I offer it to you as a choice. I don't tell you to accept my program in the name of anybody else or anything else. I ask you to consider it. I ask you to consider Rabbi Kahana's programs. I ask you to consider seriously the good parts of what he has to offer, because I think Rabbi Kahana has, certainly early in his life, made remarkable contributions to Jewish self-defense. I only wish that the origins of the JDL, which were in the protection of old people going to shul, which were in an ability to stand up to communities and tell them, we shall not be bullied. We will defend ourselves by walkie-talkies, by billy clubs, by calling the police, by recourse to all appropriate means. I only wish that hadn't denigrated into the day that that bomb was planted in Saul Yurok's office, calling and causing the meaningless, empty death of a Jewish woman. I only wish that we hadn't come to the day when rabbis in the name of halacha claim that it is appropriate to kill innocent people. And so I continue to hope and pray that all of you will define your Americanism, define your Judaism, take the best out of each, reject that which you feel uncomfortable, And in the end, the values for which we as a people have struggled for thousands and thousands of years will not be solved overnight by a false prophet. You will solve them. The people in Israel will solve them.
I think that, at the very least, on this point, I agree with my friend and alumnus, my fellow alumnus from TA. My family was certainly the influence on my life. And my father's late father was a Jewish activist. And he brought Jabotinsky into my home when I was a child. And during the war, I knew of a Holocaust that was taking place, despite the fact that the B'nai B'rit didn't. And we spoke of the Irgun, and we spoke of the actions on behalf of the Jewish people, and the wonderful things that Mr. Begin did until he unfortunately bombed the King David Hotel. I don't know what Professor Dershowitz does with the book of Joshua. I assume he has problems with it. You speak of collective action against peoples. You speak of wiping out peoples. I say to you, Judaism is not for you to pick and to choose and decide. That is not Judaism. That's Dershowitzism. It's for you to accept the yoke of heaven. Ol Malchut Shamayim. What is good and what is merciful and what is charitable and what is just is what he decrees. And sometimes that which he decrees goes against our Western grain. My opponent is a product of America with a smattering of Jewishness. I tell you, I appeal to you. Time is running out for you who live in America. Go home to Israel quickly. And in Israel, live the life of a Jew, not of a Hebrew speaking, what have you. Simple-minded solutions are usually rejected by professors. I have greater faith in the Sephardic Jew in Israel who sees my solution as the answer because he doesn't come out of Cambridge. He lived under Arabs. He knows what Arabs are. He never again wants to live under Arabs. Don't be put off by such cliches as it's a simple-minded thing. Sometimes simple-minded answers are quite good and quite correct. And sometimes not. Be good Jews. Be observant Jews. The religious way. The yoke of heaven. And live in Israel.
We've come to the summation. Friends, there is obviously a very large crowd here. The summation will last 4 minutes for each speaker. I would like to, however, ask that when both speakers finish, that you remain seated for a final word and for Hatikvah. We know that there are people downstairs and Rabbi Kahana and Professor Dershowitz will graciously be downstairs for a few moments, so there'll be that physical contact. If everyone can remain seated just in the summation, I wanted to ask each speaker just for 10 seconds at least on these questions. To Rabbi Kahana, you seem to say that you're the only halachic voice. Suppose everyone in halacha Suppose your Rebbe says that you're wrong. Would you agree? To Professor Dershowitz, do you believe that the association between Hitler, Yimach Shemo, and Rabbi Kahana is a correct one? And would you, because of your civil liberties background, defend Rabbi Kahana's right to enter into Arab villages and to, in fact, encourage Arabs to leave Israel? First speaker, Rabbi Kahana.
I think that there are a great many more rabbis in Israel than most people think who agree with what I say. In fact, part of the argument of the left, part of the angry argument is that more rabbis don't come out against me. If my Rebbe would say that I'm wrong, first of all, I would never ask him. That's the first thing. And just as Rebbe Zera, when his Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda, ruled that he should not leave Bavel to go to the land of Israel for reasons, he didn't listen to him. Because he didn't ask him, so he didn't listen to him. If I were to ask my rabbi a question and he ruled, I would be bound by it. But as a rabbi, I don't ask concerning every chicken. When I see one which has a question, I may ask if I don't know the answer. I want to spend the 2 minutes that I have left not on a summation, but rather on an appeal to you concerning Soviet Jewry. I cannot emphasize too strongly the physical Holocaust that hovers over the Jews of the Soviet Union today. That which was stopped with Stalin's death has begun to tick again. And I know, for example, that today there was a race for Soviet Jewry, and that's a good thing, because anything that anyone does is good. But believe me, with all the respect and all the honor that I give these young people, that will not save Soviet Jews today. I appeal to you to participate with us next Sunday. I am staying over purposely a few days longer. If we can nonviolently honor the memory of Dr. Martin Luther King by blocking traffic on Third Avenue, by the hundreds of just sit and sing, and as the police come and arrest you, get up and go quietly and be arrested. It's an hour. You're in and out. Believe me. And the Soviet Jew, it will make page one of the papers then. The race will not make page one. I wish it did. I wish it could. But it doesn't. Join me. I am risking something next Sunday. I have a problem with my citizenship here. And apparently the State Department has let the thing ride now. If I'm arrested next Sunday, it will awaken the devils again. And I'm doing that anyhow. I will be arrested next Sunday. Now you join me next Sunday. Just sit down. Let's get hundreds and let's get thousands out and let's revive the struggle for Soviet Jewry.